Lulania walked through the forest that had once been hers. She felt every living creature that ran or swam or flew or crawled, and her hooves left no prints in the soft earth. The great trees were thick with leaves, and all around her was life growing and changing and fighting and failing, but trying nevertheless. Once these woods had given her peace. She reached for that peace, reached for what had once been here for her, as she came to a little stream where water splashed merrily over a fallen log, and found an intruder. "Idrinase," Ululenia said, and her horn flared as she pulled upon the ties of magic and life that ran through everything nearby, most especially the trees. One tree, a great thick old monster, whose leafy branches grabbed at the sunlight, split open with a low crack, and a small figure tumbled out, a slender, feminine, foot-tall form in a short dress, with rainbow wings like a dragonfly's glowing at her back.
"Ululenia, I didn't think you would mind,"
the pixie said, her little piping voice coming fast.
"Because you were gone, and the ancients weren't coming, and I needed to be somewhere different, somewhere not where I was, and your woods were farther away, and you were not here, or I would have asked, but we were friends, so I thought you would welcome me."
"But then I came back," Ululenia said, and turned toward Idrinase. "And still you hid from me."
"It had been so long since I had seen you that I was not certain you would remember me, Ululenia. You know how we are, and I am small, and do not remember very much at all to arching ardour bejewelled bosom."
The little pixie stumbled and shook her head.
"Why are you lying?" Ululenia asked, her voice still sweet and pure and beautiful.
Idrinase shrank back nonetheless.
"You went dark, and I was afraid, Ululenia. We were friends, but those who join the dark fae do not always care about those they used to know. And I am small, Ululenia, so small and unimportant, and you would gain so little by eating me, and I could help you if you—" "Curling caress, decadent desire,"
she said, and then cried out and fell to her knees.
"You told Shenzienzis where I was."
Ululenia's horn flared again, and Idrinase flew as though struck. She rolled along the turf, then sprang to her feet and leaped for the tree she had come from, but the tree opened only a crack, straining and groaning as though held fast. The pixie clutched at the tiny crack as though she would wrench it apart with her own little hands. Ululenia's horn flared again, and the great tree, hundreds of years old and wide enough for a dozen men to link arms and encircle, cracked down the middle as though struck by lightning. Idrinase screamed, and her rainbow wings flickered and vanished as she clutched her chest. The two halves of the tree fell with a wrenching roar of tearing roots, crashing into other trees as they slowly sagged to the ground.
"You thought she was a hunter, and you told her where I was so that she could find me."
Idrinase looked up to find Ululenia standing over her, and she crawled back, whimpering.
"I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. She was going to kill me, and I was afraid, Ululenia. I was so afraid of her."
She slipped as she reached the edge of the stream. A shining white hoof pushed Idrinase into the water. She sputtered, gasped, and tried to stand, and the hoof came down, pinning her to the rocks below the surface.
"You were more afraid of her than you were of me," Ululenia said, looking down at the pixie as she struggled below the surface. "And so you betrayed me. Who are you more afraid of now, Idrinase?"
The answer came only in bubbles that popped around her fetlocks.
"I hunger as the wolf in the winter, Idrinase. As the lynx with a mouse in its jaws, I would gain so little from you. But that little would be so much more than nothing. And who would tell me that I was wrong? You betrayed me. You deserve it."
The bubbles were slowing. If Ululenia lacked patience, simply shifting her weight would crush the little insect against the rocks, and then it would crumble into the energy from which it had come, and Ululenia would be that much stronger.
"It."
Ululenia stepped back, and after a moment bent her head into the stream and pulled Idrinase out. She dropped the pixie by a tree and backed away, her hooves making no sound on the soft turf. Idrinase lay there for a while, coughing. When she could breathe, she crawled to a tree. She looked back at Ululenia, saying nothing. The tree opened beneath her touch, and the pixie stepped into it, and the tree slid shut,
and she was gone, sliding through roots and dirt to some other tree. Ulilenia could feel the magic, could track it if she wished. She did not. She pushed herself back to her human shape and looked at the dead tree, ripped in two by her fury. She looked at the stream. Her hoofprints marked the dirt at the edge, the only hoofprints she had made in her journey. She turned at a noise and saw Derry at the edge of the trees.
"You did the right thing," he said.
She was in his arms then, holding onto him as the drowning squirrel to the only rock before the waterfall, and her chest heaved as the sobs broke through.
"I want to go back," she said in his mind. "I want to go back."
Derry went off to look for Ulilenia, Hessler said, joining Tern at a market stall where she was haggling. "He's worried about her."
"He's got a pretty good track record for his worries being on target," Tern said to Hessler,
and then to the middle-aged lady selling the herbs.
"Seriously, if you have cut this with basil, what I'm doing to it will turn it into an incredibly toxic gas instead of the harmless sleep tonic I'm trying to make. So if this is like a quarter basil, I need you to tell me."
"Is no basil," said the lady. 20 for pouch."
Tern held the little bag up to her nose.
"I can smell basil in this. I need sleep tonic, not pesto sauce."
"Is no basil," said the lady again. 20 for pouch."
"Tern, Hessler," said Icy. "The puppet show is starting." Tern looked at the woman's wagon.
"You've got an Herbalist Guild membership. You know, if this turns out to have basil in it, I can bring a grievance to the guild. They usually settle because it's not worth the legal trouble, but do you know what they do to the people who besmirch their guild's reputation?"
"Maybe basil fall in," said the lady. 15 for pouch."
Tern finished the now much more reasonable purchase and followed Icy to where the puppeteer was starting up. The market had quieted and a crowd had gathered near the stage.
"Still concerned about having delegates from the Empire here for the Republic Festival of Excellence," the manticore was saying, wiggling its scorpion tail with worry. "Is that sending the right message?"
"It's sending the message that we're ready to put these decades of war behind us," the griffin said, puffing its mane a little. "And frankly, if Princess Veiled Lightning sees that the Republic is united and strong, I'm happy to have her take that back home to her mother and father."
"Veiled Lightning?" Tern looked over at Hessler. "I didn't know she was coming. Do you think we'll get to see her? We never really got to talk last time."
"Given that she was either attacking us or racing with us to prevent the destruction of the Republic and the Empire, yes," said Icy.
"But this time, if she's at the festival, we could grab a cover, right? Maybe drinks or something?"
"You know that as a member of an inheriting ruling class, Princess Veiled Lightning is invested in the systematic oppression of workers," Hessler said. "And while admittedly the Republic's de facto oligarchy and still present nobility is little better, I hardly think that she's someone to idolise."
"I don't idolise her," Tern said. "But, like, if we're having drinks, maybe she asks about my hair, and I offer to show her how I do my braids, and then she shows me how to do hers, because the instructions that came with her doll didn't have any words, and the pictures were confusing on which lock of hair went under and which went over, and then..."
"It is good to know that you do not idolize her," Icy said,
and then suddenly broke off to look back at the puppeteers, who had been going on about something Tern hadn't caught because she'd been thinking about braiding Veiled Lightning's hair.
"Clearly a time of celebration, and I don't think it's necessary to mar that with discussions of an incident from so long ago," the griffin was saying. "Yes, but next week marks the 10th anniversary of the Red Trail Massacre,"
the manticore pressed, flaring his wings and driving the griffin back.
"And the Empire has never made reparations, so I think it's justified to at least raise the question."
The dragon hopped between the griffin and the manticore, flame puffing from its mouth.
"The Red Trail Massacre was an ugly event that nearly brought the Empire and the Republic to war," it declared. "From all official information, Republic soldiers at Fort Goya were brutally slaughtered."
"Well, they had been conducting airship test fire exercises across the border," the griffin said,
hunching back from the dragon's fire.
"So it wasn't entirely unprovoked."
The manticore pounced and began banging the griffin's head on the ground, to the delight of the crowd.
It was a vicious attack that cost Republic soldiers their lives.
It wasn't even the Imperial Army, the griffin sputtered, kicking itself free.
It was some vigilante Imperial group, the Order of the Still Valley.
Where is this going?
Tern asked, and then, as she looked at Icy, added,
And also, where is he going?
Icy was making his way through the crowd, heading for the puppeteer's stage.
Then let's have the members of this Order of the Still Valley handed over into custody, the manticore bellowed.
It leaped to the griffin once more, but stopped as the dragon slapped a paw over its tail.
Strong words, the dragon roared to the crowd, with fire belching from its mouth again. But worth bringing up in this time of peace. If the Order's leader, the man who commanded the massacre, were brought into custody instead, that might avert the arrest of the entire Order.
Icy shouldered his way through the crowd.
That is enough!
Icy, what's going on?
Tern asked, following after him with Hessler in tow.
And who is the vicious warrior responsible for slaughtering so many of our soldiers during peacetime?
The manticore growled.
As I recall, the griffin said, flapping its own wings and driving the manticore back. It was Master Unstoppable Deferential Fist.
Man, Imperials and their names, Tern muttered. I mean, Indomitable Courteous Fist is pretty bad, but Unstoppable Deferential Fist is... actually synonymous.
Icy vaulted onto the stage.
Stop this performance!
Oh,
Tern said quietly. Icy strode to the side of the puppeteer's stage and flung back the curtain.
I asked you to stop this performance!
The puppets went limp, and the crowd muttered as the puppeteer stepped out. He was a middle-aged man, balding, wearing the simple dark clothes of a master puppeteer. He also wore a crimson band on his right arm.
Confirmed contact, Mr. Slant, the puppeteer said,
and his band began chiming in a signal for all to hear as he raised it at Icy. Naria had sent the guards away, leaving her and Locke alone in the throne room. She stepped down from the dais. Her rich orange gown shimmered in the light of the glow lamps, and whatever impractically high-heeled shoes she wore under the garment clicked with each step.
Come and have a carver, Issa, she said, and began walking.
Locke fell into step beside her. Even with the heels, Naria only came up to Locke's ear.
Are you sure, Naria? You come down from the throne. How am I going to remember that you're the one in charge?
Naria didn't look over. Her crystal lenses wrapped around the sides of her eyes, snaking into the frames that rested over her ears.
I think I preferred it when you called me Baroness.
I preferred it when you weren't killing people for the man who killed our parents, Locke said. Naria's pace quickened, little click, click, clicks on the stone coming faster.
I didn't know.
You're not an idiot, Naria, Locke said evenly, with no heed. You didn't want to know. Now Naria did look over. Her hair was done in an intricate series of tiny, looping braids, and the gems in her tresses tinkled at the fast movement.
When I discovered the truth, I corrected the situation.
Corrected it with a knife to Silithson's throat, as I recall. Naria stepped into a hallway, with Locke following. There were still no servants or guards.
If you remember that, you may also remember that my actions then saved your life.
And covered your tracks, Locke added, coming back to Naria's side, leaving you free to take over Lockenville as an upstanding citizen.
Is that why you're so angry? Naria asked, and smiled thinly.
Even in mockery, the expression made her lips curve sweetly, in a way that always made men want to dance for her.
But I stole the barony that was rightfully yours. Has the barony done poorly under my care, Issa? Are the people suffering?
At Locke's stony silence, Naria laughed again.
Don't be shy, Issa. I know that my big sister would have looked at the town as she came in, and Issa Vasira de Lockenville was always ready to pass judgment.
Locke took a slow breath in through her nose. You've done well. Naria raised an eyebrow.
But part of you still believes you could have done better.
I didn't say that.
Perhaps you'd be Baroness today if you hadn't run off to join the army, Naria added. You were so eager to fight. What if you'd fought here against the men who killed mother and father and left me alone and blinded? Do you think you might have saved them?
She took the crystal lenses from her face, and Locke saw the ugly scars across her dead, white eyes. Naria didn't stop walking, though. Both she and Locke could walk the manor from memory.
"Do you think I might be looking at my sister face to face, instead of through this damned magic?"
Locke chuckled, and Naria started, then shoved the lenses back onto her face as she turned a corner. Locke asked, "Does the Damsel in Distress Act work for the nobles like it did on all the boys?"
Naria glared, possibly the first honest expression Locke had seen on her that day, and Locke added,
"After you put a knife in Silliston's throat, you left me hanging over a mile-long drop with a broken rib. I could have used a hand."
Naria stopped at a large double door. Locke remembered the small sitting room inside, where her father and mother had shared drinks and gossip with old friends. "I knew you'd be fine, Issa. You were always a strong one. You were the fighter, the survivor, the one who could do everything on her own. I'm not like you."
She gestured politely, and Locke stepped to the doors. They opened before her. Baron Westyke stood inside, with three black-coated paladins flanking him. Quietly, Naria said,
"I have to make compromises.